It's time for your KDNK local newscast for this Friday morning, October 7th. I'm Gavin Dahl. Ursa Resources will not pursue permits for a proposed natural gas well pad and parachute, according to the Post Independent. In a letter to Garfield School District 16 and county commissioners sent Wednesday, Ursa stated their proposal did not meet the absolute best criteria. The company's concerns are more about impacts, such as truck traffic, than safety or health, despite the pad's 700-foot proximity to Grand Valley High School. The company will continue to evaluate alternatives for drilling from the pad, but for now, all plans are on hold. Amy Haddon Marsh wants you to know about the 8th Street Bridge closure.
The 8th Street Bridge over the Roaring Fork River in Glenwood Springs will close for construction for 10 days, beginning tomorrow, Saturday, October 8th, through Tuesday, October 18th. This bridge connects downtown to Midland Avenue. The closure will have a significant impact on daily traffic to and from downtown. Here are some things to watch out for. Traffic signals will change at Midland Avenue and West 8th Street up by Veltus Park. The northbound Midland Avenue signal will be removed, and the southbound Midland and 8th Street signals will change to a flashing light. Cowden Drive residents will have access from West 8th Street to Midland Avenue. Cyclists and pedestrians will still be able to use the bridge sidewalk. CDOT crews have added a second left turn lane at 27th Street and Grand Avenue and will also change the timing of the light to mitigate traffic backups in the 27th Street roundabout and on Midland Avenue. Raft to bus configurations will also change temporarily. The Garfield County Courthouse bus stop and the 7th Street stop will be closed during this time. Riders are encouraged to debus at the Grand Avenue 9th Street stop instead. Rafta buses will also use Highway 6 and 24 and the Grand Avenue Bridge between the Meadows in West Glenwood and the 27th Street BRT station in South Glenwood. As for school traffic, in the morning, students will be transferred from bus to bus at Glenwood Springs High School. For middle school students who live in South Glenwood, Sopers Elementary will be the transfer station in the afternoons. More information about the bridge closure is at rfta.com and the Garfield County website. For KDNK, I'm Amy Haddon Marsh.
Denver-based Associated Press reporter Sadie Gurman published a major national investigation into police database abuse last week, along with AP's Justice Department reporter Eric Tucker. Officers across the country have been routinely misusing confidential databases to get information having nothing at all to do with daily police work on romantic partners, business associates, neighbors, and journalists. Patrol officers, dispatchers, civilian employees, court personnel, even high-ranking police officials who've gotten caught abusing confidential databases are rarely prosecuted, but some are involved in very creepy stuff like stalking, tampering with criminal cases, even trading confidential information for sexual favors. Just how widespread is this problem in the United States?
Well, our review found that this happens fairly regularly, but our tally was certainly under count. What we did was we filed open records requests to 50 different states and more than 35 big city police departments asking for how many times officers had been disciplined for this. And some states refused to give us the information, said it wasn't public record, never produced documents, or provided information that was so confusing and opaque, it was not that we couldn't get a meaningful count from it. So we found that 325 officers between 2013 and 2015 were fired, suspended, or resigned for doing this. And there were about 250 others who received lesser punishment, like reprimands and counseling. But that number is certainly higher. You know, in some cases, it's just very difficult, if not impossible, to distinguish a questionable search from a legitimate search.
You said some states actually refused to disclose this information to you. Here in Colorado, you didn't have particularly good luck getting details, but very few officers got more than a reprimand. Is that right?
The Colorado Bureau of Investigation provided us with more than 35 incidents when this happened, except for they didn't provide any information on how and or whether the officers were punished. But in the Denver Police Department, which we also queried, most of the officers found to have done this received nothing more than a written reprimand.
Wow. So you said that you guys filed a lot of open records requests. How long did this story take, and what was the reporting process like?
So we started this story back in March. Denver's Independent Monitor had put out a report that said officers within the department were using confidential databases for personal use. And we wanted to raise the question of whether anybody was keeping this type of information nationwide. And the answer was no. And we quickly found out why that was, because there are so many different systems and there's not one central repository for the information. So it took us about 6 months to put in the inquiries and wait for the inquiries to come back, and then also to just sort of determine what exactly it was we were looking at. There was no uniformity really in the reports that we received as a result of our open records request. So it was very laborious, and it took us about 6 months.
Whistleblower Ed Snowden tweeted a mock headline for your story as if BuzzFeed had published it, writing, "This government got total access to your private life, and you'll never guess what happened next." What kind of information is accessible to cops in the databases they can access?
They can access the national NCIC, which is like a national repository that's maintained by the FBI that contains information on things like, missing persons, stolen cars, wanted suspects, people with terrorist ties, that type of thing. It's just a huge repository for information that receives millions of legitimate queries every single day. And then they're also connected to the state versions of that database, which provide officers with DMV records. So information on both law-abiding citizens and wanted suspects. As a law-abiding citizen, you are in this database. They have instant access to your personal information, basically.
So you did find instances of discipline imposed on officers. What are a couple examples of cops getting busted for this?
So I think one of the ones that you sort of alluded to was a Phoenix police officer who basically was giving a woman who was involved in a gun and drug trafficking undercover investigation. He was giving her information about stolen vehicles in exchange for her arranging sexual favors for him. And she told an undercover detective that she would give him anything he wanted for $100, any information. So that person was fired. And in Denver, there was an officer who met a hospital employee during the course of a sex assault investigation, looked up her phone number, and called her at home, basically. And she found that very off-putting.
Yikes. So what did you learn from talking to victims of these crooked cops?
The sense I got from almost all the victims that I talked to was just this feeling of vulnerability. Most of them did not know what happened with their information, but they just had this feeling like, well, it's out there now, and, it could be traded, it could be sold. They just felt still very rattled and very vulnerable as a result of, being queried inappropriately and not knowing how that information was being used. In one of the cases, my colleague talked to a woman in Ohio who said basically that these illegitimate searches by her ex-boyfriend, who was a cop, sort of exacerbated her domestic abuse situation. So it ran a gambit, really.
It's not just a betrayal of trust or a way to make some extra money, like the officer in Michigan who sold confidential information to attorneys for years. Sometimes these abuses by those who are supposed to protect and serve are actually political in nature. The story of a former county commissioner in Minnesota was alarming, too.
So I went to Minnesota and talked to Deb Roshan, who was a former county commissioner in Wabasha County, and she had opposed several sheriff's department programs. She was sort of a critic and questioned county spending, and she said that as a result of that, law enforcement and government officials searched her and her fellow politicians hundreds of times, and at times when she, wasn't even on the road, and they were searching for her family members just at off hours, that suggested to her that this was not a legitimate search.
Now that you've learned so much about this unsettling problem, what can be done?
People are charged typically in the course of other criminal activity. It's been suggested, that stronger discipline would be a deterrent to this. Some police departments have put in better safeguards by doing things like quarterly audits where officers can be asked to explain their searches randomly, but there is no real foolproof safeguard because a lot of times it's difficult to distinguish an illegitimate search from the millions of legitimate searches that happen every day, and officers need these tools. So it's kind of a work in progress, I guess.
Sadie Gurman is a reporter for the Associated Press. We'll link to her expose on police abuse of confidential databases nationwide on our website at kdnk.org. Thanks so much for speaking with me, Sadie.
Thank you.
Colorado ranks 48th in the nation for spending on behavioral health, but that could change with the November election. Eric Gladys reports.
Two measures on the November ballot could affect how Colorado delivers behavioral and mental health care. Amendment 72 would increase the tax on a pack of cigarettes by $1.75 statewide, money that would go to health programs, research, and training. And Larimer County voters will be asked to approve a 0.25% sales tax increase to build a detox and substance abuse treatment center. Lori Stolen with the county says the center could put a stop to expensive emergency room visits.
After decades of trying to put Band-Aids on our gaps in behavioral health care in Larimer County, we finally come up with what we feel is the most viable solution to fill these gaps.
She says for every dollar invested in treatment, taxpayers save $4 in criminal justice and hospital costs, and emergency room visits decline by more than 45% when patients can access behavioral health care. Mo Keller with Mental Health Colorado says raising cigarette taxes would help Colorado invest in educating young people. She adds Colorado ranks 48th in the nation in per capita funding for behavioral health services and near the bottom for the number of available beds.
Currently, 35% of prison inmates, for example, have a diagnosable mental illness, and the prison system in Colorado is the largest provider of residential mental health services in the state.
Keller notes 72% of people incarcerated in the state have histories of severe substance abuse. Stoller says when the only two options for addressing behavioral and mental health are hospitals and jails, taxpayers end up on the hook and problems are left unresolved.
So many people have come forward and told their story of how they've been personally impacted by a family member, a brother, a mom, a dad, in some way because of a substance abuse or a mental health issue.
According to a 2015 report by the League of Women Voters of Colorado, one in four people nationally has a mental health or substance use disorder. For KDNK, I'm Eric Galatis.